Hello, everybody. Today we have something special for you. It is a crossover episode between CTI and the China Econ Talk podcast. A few weeks back, James and I met up with Jordan Schneider, who is the host of the China Econ Talk podcast, at James' apartment in Beijing. And the three of us had a chat, and we put it on wax, as the kids say these days. So we talk about live streaming and e-commerce in China. We talk about generations of Chinese entrepreneurs. We talk about WeChat versus Facebook, and we talk about risk management when it comes to stock investing and whether stock investing is worth it. So I hope you enjoy it. You can also check it out on the China Econ Talk feed as well if you subscribe to that. So enjoy the crossover episode we're calling China Econ Tech Investor.
Rap music, China, what do they even say? What is this Chinese rap music? Sounds like they're just saying Ching Chang Tong.
My chance, new girl, watch Made in China. We play ping pong ball, Made in China.
Hello and welcome to China Econ Talk. I'm your host, Jordan Schneider, here today with the China Tech Investor podcast team. Elliot Zagman and James Hull talking today about e-commerce in China, the lessons that Facebook is apparently learning from WeChat, as well as the value or lack thereof in picking individual stocks to invest in. Elliot and James, welcome to China Econ Talk.
Great to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Jordan.
Yeah, it's going to be in the same place. You know, usually when James and I record, we're in, you know, God knows wherever. And I know that's kind of the situation with you too, isn't it, Jordan?
Lots of remote interviews. So, Elliot, I hear you've been tramping around live streaming studios in southern China.
Yeah, well, I'm on a Grand China tour for the month of March. So I've been in Hong Kong, Shanghai, up in Beijing right now for about 10 days. And then I was in Hangzhou earlier for about a week. For those who listen to our podcast, the China Tech Investor podcast, powered by Technode, they'll know that, you know, I'm a columnist and obviously a podcast host, but I also work a lot as kind of a PR consultant, usually for China tech founders, usually of either pre-IPO or recently IPO'd, you know, kind of small cap companies, $1 to $2 to $3 billion. But one company that I work for is a company called Mogu, like mushroom, basically. Okay. I talked about them a little bit. But what they do is, you know, they invited me to just kind of come and hang out for a week with them in Hangzhou. And they do a lot of these fashion live streams where basically what they have is these kind of these key opinion leaders, these influencers who will do these maybe 4 or 5 hour live streams every night. You know, they're usually funny. They're these very good improvisers. And they'll just sell clothes or cosmetics or whatnot. And a lot of them, they'll just make a killing. But one of them that I visited was this girl named a young woman named Xiao Tianxin, or Little Sweetheart. So, and I thought they were going to say, you're going to visit some of our influencers. And what I was thinking is, I'm going to visit this girl's apartment. She's going to have, you know, one of those circle lights set up. Yeah. And, you know, that's what I imagined, basically. We get there. It's a warehouse outside the city, right? Her husband comes down to meet us and he goes, you know, do you want to come and take a look at our whole facility here? And I'm like, a whole facility? Like, what is this? So they send us over to this big, you know, warehouse space. There's an assembly line where there are basically, they said they have 60 different workers who are all basically inspecting clothes that she sells during her live stream. And then you have a whole another assembly line of people basically just packing them up and shipping them out. So they do millions of US dollars in sales per month.
So just this, again, this is just the husband and wife team featuring the 5 hour, very cute, very compelling live streamer.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's kind of like QVC.
Okay.
Or Home Shopping Network or something like that. But it's online.
By the way, when I was a kid, I remember those like baseball card ones. And then my whole vision of adulthood would be like, one day I am going to like have $80 to buy a Mickey Mantle signed card or whatever. And now I have $80 to buy a Mickey Mantle signed card and am not. But apparently, you know, the dream, the business model still lives, most certainly.
Yeah. So, you know, they also have like a big customer service team. Basically what the main show is up in this room, they have a studio and it's this young woman, this girl from this, you know, small town in Henan. You know, she's a pretty normal, you know, Chinese girl, but you could tell probably she's not you know, super educated or professionally polished or anything. She's just a young woman. And her sister, basically, for 5 hours each night, 7 days a week, they will live stream to 1 to 2 million people.
Yeah.
And they have a huge rack of clothes, all of which they have purchased directly from these factories. And they basically all curate themselves. And then they will basically, you know, her husband, who, you know, runs this with her, and some other colleagues are basically just selling them as they're showing them. So she's curating them, selling them, and you know, just basically buying directly from the factories and then sending them right through her warehouse and then sending them on out.
What are like kind of the costs, the prices they're selling these items for? Like, what kind of range are we talking about?
For these guys, it's pretty cheap. So basically what they're doing is, it's probably similar quality to something that you might get at Zara, but it's probably half the price.
Yeah.
Right? So we've seen this a lot with like Taobao, right? You know, just go on Taobao, you can get all that clothes. But we also know with Taobao that there's a quality issue.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, in China, I think if you live here for a while, I mean, this is, I think, a little uniquely China, but not exclusively China, is that people don't always trust those like systems, right? What they do trust is somebody that they know. Right. And if someone says, oh, you can trust this person, you can trust this company, they're like, yeah, cool, I'll go with it. And that's really where live streamers have filled this hole, right? Fallen into this void where, you know, if I don't know, I want to get some clothes, but I don't know if they're good or not, I know that I can trust what Xiao Tianxin is good, right? So, or says is good. And I think we see this on Instagram a lot too. It's where it's starting to come up. But I think in China, it's, you know, they're just light years ahead, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Instagram. I don't spend my Instagram time, you know, looking at, you know, Kylie Jenner or these kind of folks. Right. But from what I understand, you know, you can do some e-commerce, but you basically have to click on something that'll take you to another site. You know, it's not really, you know, closely integrated or seamlessly integrated.
I think they did a beta sort of test or some sort of test with Kate Spade where Kate Spade had an ad and you click it and it would open up. It's still in Instagram, but it's like another interface that you have to, but you could make a purchase through Instagram was the whole thing. This was last year, I think. Yeah.
You know, I do find it interesting. There's this this new documentary, I forget the name of it. It kind of paints the world of live streaming as this like
people's desire.
Yeah, like people's desire.
People's
desire,
republic yeah. of desire. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you know, there's like there is like a kind of hellscape aspect to this world. But I think it's also important to understand that you know, there's actually a lot of talent that goes into it. Just because you are young and pretty does not get you a million followers buying all your stuff. You know, as you said, there's an aspect of like of entertainment and being engaging. And especially if you're like a woman and your audience are females, like sex appeal is not going to be what wins you followers in the end.
Exactly.
So, I mean, there's a real art. I mean, I don't know about art form, but there's a lot of preparation and skill that really goes into this and being able to keep people entertained and coming back to you on a day-to-day basis. And trust is a pretty difficult thing to build live streaming over a phone, right?
Exactly.
You have watching to have every once in a while, and to be able to do that, I think is something really remarkable.
So one of the cool things in People's Republic of Desire was because you could, as a viewer of these influencers, you could interact with them, and you could start to develop a connection or some sort of relationship with them, and you would actually, they become almost like your friend. Like you wanted to spend time watching them on their show and listening to them, and they were saying things that you identified with in your life that you weren't even able to verbalize, right?
Yeah.
And so it created this cool kind of, and I think, you know, that documentary is great. I really liked it, but it got at this kind of, that there's some, like something lacking for the young people here where they can't find like people that really cater to their views or their situations and circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit difficult for me to talk about this because, I mean, normally try to keep, you know, what I do, you know, professionally or for money away from what I do as like you know,
journalism.
Yeah. So it's a little, I have to be very delicate here. But yeah, I do think, you know, visiting these people, like it's not, you can tell like their lives are not always easy. You know, in some ways, like I compared it to a professional athlete, like the amount that they're working and the amount that you can tell there is a physical toll that I think it takes on a lot of them.
Yeah.
They also they don't know how long the success is going to last, and they're very successful. And there are a lot worse ways to make, and a lot more dishonest ways to make a success out of yourself, you know? Yeah. And they're doing well, they're setting up their families, you know, and you know, for a lot of these people, they could probably stop doing this after a couple of years and be set for life, yeah. You know, if for the really successful ones. And yeah, that is something that I did notice, you know, with that one young woman that I saw, is that she had excellent improv skills.
Yeah.
Like her and her sister were standing there in front of the live stream. And they're basically, you know, going back and forth, changing, you know, just from outfit to outfit. And at the same time, she's talking to her audience. She's making jokes. You know, she's this incredibly likable person and very, very funny. And you can see she's just, like I said, she is, I don't want to say, I think it can be taken the wrong way to say she's just some girl from Hunan, but she also is like a girl next door. You know, yeah. You can tell she's not from like a super educated or super rich family. She's not super glamorous. You can tell if you are just your average 20-something young woman in, you know, a small, you know, not from Beijing or Shanghai, but from a third or fourth tier city in China. You know, I can see why they would really resonate with her. And she's probably making these people's lives a little bit better, bringing a little happiness to them.
Yeah.
Giving them, you know, a reason to buy a product, you know. And, you know, I think that, you know, obviously there are always downsides of things like this and, you know, new aspects of the digital economy. But I think that if you're against that, I think, you know, you're against a lot of entrepreneurship.
Yeah. I mean, who's losing out? Like Zara and H&M, right? Like these are the folks that these people are stealing market share from. So it's an interesting trend, and it's like, you know, it's a real long tail thing. It's a real internet enabled thing, and these are little small and medium sized businesses, and it'll be interesting to see which ones of them are going to create the Gucci's and Pradas of China 10, 15 years.
Yeah, from. Yeah, and that's I think what's so cool about it is that I also visited, you know, in like Zhejiang and Guangdong, both basically have, you know, the entire kind of fashion, you know, value chain ecosystem, all in just a couple square miles of each other, really. Yeah. I mean, you have the designers from Gucci or Chanel or whatever that come and say, okay, well, this is what's in style this year. But the whole rest of it, from, you know, the mid to low tier designers, you know, that will design the clothes for, say, Zara. A lot of them are Chinese, and then they basically just show the Zara people, like, you know, these are the designs we might want to do this year. Pick them out and say which ones you want to go with, and then, you know, we'll make them. And so you have, you know, the fabric, the manufacturing, the wholesale. There's so much of this that is all just in this small ecosystem, and a lot of these people that are really kind of these budding designers. So you have all this design talent down there too, where, you know, I think over the next few years we can really start to see some of these homegrown Chinese brands that, you know, will they be successful abroad? I don't know, but they'll definitely have some success in China, that's for sure.
Sure. I recently read this book called Amatora, which was this, I think, American who's been in and around Japan for a long time, writing about the evolution of men's fashion in Japan since 1945. And it told this fascinating arc of Japan evolving from a fashion society that was very buttoned down, very tight, and slowly but surely getting these new influences from the West and taking their own spin on things and craving this sort of authenticity and kind of growing and evolving to, you know, the streetwear and the bathing apes of the world. And now Japan is commonly acknowledged as like a premier fashion, you know, a global fashion capital that you know, fashionistas all around the world get cues from. And it was interesting thinking about reading this book and thinking about the ingredients that they needed for that success. So first, I think the guy talked about the importance of having this kind of global influence and global mindset. A lot of the first cues that the Japanese took to bring in more global influences came from the American occupation and all these GIs running around, and they're the ones with the money and they have the cool clothes and whatnot. And so that was kind of the first big influx. And then it also took disposable income of people being willing to spend on quality, which is obviously something that China has in spades. But the other really interesting aspect was this idea of these, you know, kind of pretty out there individuals who cared a lot about a particular subculture and were willing to live very alternative lifestyles and invest their toil and labor into creating fantastic products that were edgy, and that the police weren't necessarily happy seeing kids walking around on in Shibuya. And there's, I think, a general idea of cool fashion being something that has to be pissing older people off and being against the mainstream societal grain and being something that's a little subversive. And it's an open question whether that last ingredient of like toleration of subversiveness is something or not even necessarily toleration, but like, you know, not risking going to jail for subversiveness is something that you are going to be end up seeing in the Chinese fashion world. So, you know, I mean, just I was, you know, I'm watching this terrible iQIYI.
Dou Tinghao.
No, it's like Chun Yan's. It's like a American Idol, but for male idols who are all like 18 to 25. And at some point, I think 2 weeks ago, the government decided that all the hair had to be black. So no tattoos. Yeah. So not just no tattoos, but no blonde highlights. So iQIYI had to go back and remaster the whole episode. This like, you know, these 3 hour long episodes and just like, you know, do the Photoshop, like pour black paint on all their heads. And it looked absurd.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, you know, this is like, if you want to rebel against something, like, here you go. Right. But at the same time, it's an interesting tension between having societal things you can push back against and just being too quashed that your idea never ends up getting the traction it needs to take you places. So. Yeah,
it's interesting that you mentioned iQIYI because so James and I on our podcast, for those of you who don't listen to our podcast regularly, we have a watch list of different Chinese tech companies that we kind of follow their stocks. We follow their quarterly earnings and just keep track of them. And one of them is iQIYI. And this is a common discussion that we have when it comes to iQIYI is that they have a potential overseas market with their content. You know, they could be a potential global competitor to Netflix. But that is an issue, is that how can they make content that is, you know, globally appealing and globally competitive when there are a lot more restrictions on what kind of content can be published within China?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if they have to double create, double produce things that are completely different, it's just the cost of it kind of, it outweighs the benefit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is an interesting idea. I mean, how subversive do you have to be to be considered cool? You know, could you be subtly subversive? You know, you have one streak of a blonde, like, highlight, and that's like subversive enough.
Yeah.
Or a mischievous grin.
Right.
It all takes us a look, right? Turning now to the relatively recent news with regards to Facebook's big new privacy push. A lot of Western as well as Chinese media, I've seen a few WeChat articles about this, talking about how a lot of the cues that Facebook is taking seem to be coming directly from Tencent and the social media ecosystem that WeChat has spawned. So any thoughts about this? What's going on here? And where do you see the differences when it comes to data privacy and the like coming from a consumer perspective?
Okay, I guess I'll start. So I think Facebook bought WhatsApp in 2014. I kind of thought when they bought it that they would start immediately implementing kind of a WeChat clone, bringing in more like groups and kind of having like a moments thing added to it. But then you're kind of competing with Facebook feed. Like when Mark did his memo, he did talk about, you know, how privacy, encryption, and kind of the one-to-one or one to a small group of people kind of communications and ephemeralness of stories is the major growth area for social media right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, China, there's, I don't think many people talk about privacy or their ideals of privacy or how they view, you know, whether the data, wonder the government's collecting data on them. But I think people are aware of it. I just don't think it's talked about very much.
Yeah. Well, this is something that I think also in the last year that I've noticed has changed. But yeah, I don't see it being talked about on Chinese social media. But I do when I talk to my friends in China, and my friends obviously are not representative of the average Chinese citizen, but I do hear them talking about privacy in ways that they never did before. Mm. They're far more aware of it now. Like, or when I know, like, a lot of these reports about the social credit system in China, I think a lot of it is overhyped, particularly from mainstream media overseas. But even when I've said to Chinese friends something like, oh, well, you know, like, there are a lot of positive things that can come out of it, like, a lot of my Chinese friends will be like, no, that's scary.
Yeah.
And I do think that, you know, it is a complex issue, but I've been surprised by how many of my Chinese friends are a little, you know, freaked out by it. But also, they're not representative of the average Chinese person. You know, they're in Beijing, they're wealthier, they're more educated than the average Chinese person.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of my takeaway on that. But with I do think that we've seen a pretty big, just kind of global, paradigm shift.
Yeah.
When it comes to privacy, and it is a very important discussion, but we see this with GDPR in Europe, you know, where I think James and I have talked about this before, and just about everybody I know has been reading that Shoshana Zuboff, the Surveillance Capitalism book. Mm. I'm listening to it right now. I don't read books. I listen to books. But basically, you know, she goes into great detail about how many of these business models are based on basically extracting data from our lived experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, using them for profit, but also using them for predictive kind of manipulation of our behavior, right? So James and I have talked about this before. I don't know if we recorded this, but we talked about Pokemon Go, for example,
right,
and how one monetization option for Pokemon Go is that they allowed, you know, like, Burger King can sponsor Pokemon Go.
And
then the Pokemon gym is
that
Burger King, right? So, and it, you know, this is one thing. I mean, it's in the US, I think it's more about, like, how, you know, just the whole, like, capitalist system and the financial system can just, you know, completely walk away with it. But in China, there's the financial component and the capitalistic component, but there's also, you know, the social control component as well, you know, politically, that I think, you know, is also in thought about from, you know, by a lot of people as well. So, and one thing I think that WeChat does do is I don't see that too much from WeChat, at least at this point.
You mean the gathering and trying to manipulate and kind of nudge you certain ways, gathering of your data?
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't really opened their ecosystem up to advertisers. Like, the ads I do see on WeChat, which I've been seeing more of, but the ones I do see seem to be pretty well curated and more like design, like, cool, high quality. And maybe that's because they're targeting me for something, but I don't know.
I think it's interesting just kind of imagining what real privacy would look like on the Facebook platform, which I think we can get a little peek in through our experience of WeChat. So you want to talk about a little bit about how contactless work and how that ends up meaning you have a radically different kind of understanding and relationship to all these people as opposed to being a Facebook friend with them?
Mm. Well, yeah.
I mean, the biggest difference, right, is that, you know, on WeChat, you add someone, and usually the first thing you do when you add someone is you can, like, tag them or, like, set your preferences, whatever, to, you know, if they're, like, work, you can tag them as work-related, whatever. But you also look at their moments, and you can scroll through someone's moments and you can start to see, like, your other contacts that you're connected to on WeChat have liked their moments. And that means that you have a similar connection. Whereas there's no really other way to see that, right?
Yeah. There's you know, on Facebook, you click see ones like, oh, we have 70
right.
common
it's
friends.
Very
like, I know exactly
yeah,
who
yeah.
you know. Like,
yeah.
I know where you work. I know what, you know, football team you yeah. like just, and whatnot. I mean, there's just much yeah. less on there from a public profile standpoint and from a just general, you know, information that you can glean from someone's public WeChat profile.
And it's, I think, well, another thing to keep into consideration here is just the business models of Facebook versus Tencent. And that, you know, we've talked about this on, because Tencent's obviously on one of the companies on our watch list, is that Facebook's main business is the ads. Tencent has a very diversified revenue stream, basically. So they have gaming.
And oh, it's gaming majority gaming.
It's majority gaming, yeah.
Yeah.
But they're also going into a number of different avenues. They have they've invested
very gaming is very profitable, and it can fund loss leaders kind of things like WeChat. I mean, I think Alan Jiang, right, his the main goal with WeChat was to make it useful to your life, whereas the main goal for Facebook was to connect everybody, and the connection would lead to better outcomes for Facebook. But then there's that really, and I think it's in the book, but there's that memo that came out from the Facebook kind of VP or something about how connections and openness is always good, even if it leads to violence, even if it leads to like bad things that happen in the world, it's still good for Facebook. So we must drive for it. So it's like this, it's actually,
cultish almost. It's gone. It's extremist.
It's gone beyond morals. Like they're literally, they've gone over the deep end. I don't know. I kind of fall in the camp where I think they probably should be broken up. I actually think Mark Zuckerberg should support that, because I think he'll get wealthier when it's broken up, because he'll own all these separate things and they all do well.
They get Rockefellered.
Rockefeller, same thing happened to him. But anyway, yeah, I think I don't know if Apple should be broken up, but anyway, I don't want to take the conversation there unless we want to go there.
Another great book that I read recently is The Four by Scott Galloway. So he looks into Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Google. You know, he's a compelling writer, and just really looks at these, does a good job of looking at these companies from many different angles. But yeah, it was a very eye-opening. But one thing that I wonder about, and this gets back to the investment in the stock thing, is that I believe Google was the first company, or the first tech IPO, to issue the two separate classes of shares, right? That kept Sergey and Larry basically in charge of the company. And this is also what keeps Mark Zuckerberg in charge.
Right. I don't know if they were the first, but maybe. Yeah.
One of the first. The first big one. I don't know. This is what I could fact check me on that one. But I think it does create, I mean, these people are, they have a very specific set of experiences that is, leading them to have a very specific worldview. Mm. And they don't often have a lot of people telling them no. They don't hear a lot of different perspectives all the time. And what it has created is a sense of kind of, I guess, like a Silicon Valley fundamentalism, I think might be one way to put it, in that we're seeing kind of the negative side of right now, in that like in Facebook's case, is connection is always better.
Yeah.
Right? Where they build up this kind of, it's almost a cult-like, attitude. And I think we also saw this, in some ways, I think, in looking back at like the Arab Spring.
At the New Zealand shooting that just happened. I mean, that's connection. That was live streamed, and that's not good for the world.
But at least we're acknowledging that's bad. Right. I think during the Arab Spring, looking back, I think there's a whole lot of ways that we maybe didn't foresee a lot of, the effect
negative.
That it had. But there was a very much like, Facebook and Twitter are causing democratic revolutions, right?
And there was a sense of pride from that. I remember.
Yeah, but like this idea that like Thomas Jefferson was just going to arise in Egypt, right, and create this like a liberal democracy in Egypt.
That's a little 2020.
Yeah, there, 2020 hindsight.
Going back to China a bit. It's interesting because there's that Big Four book. I'm still waiting to read that one about China. There's a fair number of books covering individual companies. I found most of them to be very hagiographic, very much like look at how awesome and brilliant the founder is.
Access journalism.
Yeah, and like half of them have been written by BCG partners. No offense to BCG, but it's if you work as a consultant for these companies for 20 years, and then it's kind of hard to expect people to write a real critical.
Yeah. You've been giving them ideas that they've implemented that you're tied to in some way. Yeah.
So, maybe the book is out there and I haven't found it yet, but it's there's so much to write about when it comes to doing like big comparative analysis of these Chinese ecosystem companies. And as I'm sure you guys have talked about and I've talked about on my show, it's like as these companies grow more and more and have more and more of a global imprint, it's really important to understand what makes them tick. So looking forward for the next generation of journalists, both domestically in China and then foreigners coming in to take a real critical eye and really understand what makes these places work. Because understanding them, just like understanding Facebook, is really important if you want to know what's going on in the 21st century. It's going to be the same for a lot of these Chinese firms.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think that, I just spoke at a Bookworm event on a panel with the global VP of PR at Huawei and Josh Shin from the Wall Street Journal. And that's basically was my argument with Huawei is that, you know, like, I don't know. I've written a lot about Huawei. Like, I don't know whether or not what the U.S. government is accusing them of is true or false. Like, I started writing about them just about their company culture. And some of the issues that they had there, and it was nothing political, and the whole political thing kind of, you know, it makes me a little bit uncomfortable with them. But like, that's ultimately my issue here is that they're such an important company. They will write a lot of the rules, especially in the developing world, for the future of connectivity. And if we don't know enough about that company, and if they continue to be as closed as they are, right? I do believe that is kind of a disservice to, you know, to the world, right? And I think that they have a different set of degree of responsibility. But that is true with a lot of these Chinese tech companies. But one thing I do notice, and I think what makes Huawei a little bit different, is that, you know, Ren Zhengfei is 75 years old. He's an older generation, 74.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see that there's generally, you know, Alibaba has been more open than Huawei has been until maybe just recently with Huawei. And now with a lot of the companies that I work with, these are younger 30-something founders and entrepreneurs. Also, I think it what I like about it is that they're a lot smaller, so they don't have, you know, all the same kind of things to worry about as the bigger companies. But it's much easier to have an open conversation about who they are, what they're trying to do, and what their business models are, what kind of cultures they want to build. And they are very, very forward thinking about that. And that's also why I do like, I'm so encouraged by kind of the Ba Ling Ho, the post 80s entrepreneurial generation, is because I find them to be just, you know, not only are they, you know, super hardworking and entrepreneurial, but they're very forward thinking. I would say that a lot of them are far more, you know, they're more humanistic. So I think in the future, we're going to get probably a much more accurate book about the Chinese entrepreneurs that have kind of come of age in the last few years than we had with, for example, like, you know, the Alibaba book by Duncan Clark, which is, you know, a little bit of an advertisement for the company.
Yeah. Just to preview an episode I have coming out in a little bit with Christopher Marquise, who's a researcher. And basically what he's done is try to understand like how living through the Great Leap Forward and living through the Cultural Revolution impacted your decision making. He does it. He looks at these data sets that are, it's like, are you more conservative because you live through you were living in a city that like had big food shortages or something. But, you know, it's not just that you're less comfortable raising debt, right? It's also that, you know, you grew up in a universe in which foreigners were devils. And, you were imbibed with this very red ideology. And growing, as you were talking about, the 80s generation and the 90s generation even more, it's a more global, it's a more open mindset that values different things, that has different priorities. And watching how that plays out is going to be one of the fascinating stories of the 21st century.
Yeah, so, and it's probably one of the things that makes me most optimistic about China and the Chinese economy and China's place in the world.
Have you recorded that episode yet?
Thursday morning.
I do wonder, like, one of my kind of hypotheses has been that the people who lived through the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward and all that, they tend to value more so than other generations stability. And that because they lived through such unstable, just ridiculous environments and had to really struggle and sort of survive, right? You know, I think like eventually maybe 4 or 5 generations down the road, which is like 80 to 100 years, that might kind of peter out and kind of this emphasis on stability might eventually kind of, you know, get loosened.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think just this is a global phenomenon, right? My grandparents, they lived through the Great Depression and, you know, my parents had a bit of that growing up. And like, here I am having this really weird life path and like hanging out in China. And had I been closer to that kind of like seminal sociological event, maybe I would most certainly have a different sort of risk tolerance and different mindset. So, you know, this is a global thing, not just a China story. Yeah. Though I would say, you know, the extremes of what happened in 20th century China, I think are as crazy as you get if you want to pick a lifetime arc.
Yeah, if you look at World War II and the people who fought there, I mean, that was not as long as the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. I mean, it was probably on the same similar magnitude of like disruptive, but not as long.
But and I also do think that this has a lot to do with these. You know, this is for a long time. This has kind of been a big issue of mine and kind of something I've been trying to like wrestle with and like just kind of asking why. Is just the transparency issue, not just with like, you know, the Communist Party or whatnot with China, but a lot of these companies as well. You know, like, why can't they be more open and honest with their consumers and with the public about just what they are as a company, especially because a lot of times the companies aren't that bad, right? There's nothing really that, like, yeah. What are they hiding? But I think
it's like, hard to prove, right? That the problem is that, like, if everyone expects something and then you have to prove that you're not that, it's like anything you say that says you're not is sort of like, yeah.
Huawei, it's really hard to win at this point.
Yeah. But I would argue with Huawei though, at this point, like, I mean, it's hard to come back at this point, but like part of it is like,
they could have done something
they've
done,
been not, yeah. that they've been, you know, doing this for decades.
More proactive.
Yeah. But I do think, you know, if you look at, you know, the stories from like the Cultural Revolution, it was a lot of, you know, and I don't, I'm very hesitant to get too into like Ren Zhengfei's psyche or anything like that.
Yeah.
But you did have, you know, where, you know, first of all, trust was just destroyed in a lot of these cities.
Sure.
Where, you know, you just had neighbor going after neighbor, family going after family, and something that was okay just a few days ago, or a political leader who you'd support just a few weeks ago, right? And that was fine. All of a sudden, that makes you a counter-revolutionary or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, what do you do in that situation? What's the wisest move? The wisest move is just to not say anything.
Yeah.
Because saying anything, you don't know if it's going to get you in trouble later. So you can understand a little bit from that perspective. But also, I could see how that impacts a lot of people. I don't know about him in particular, but I think in that generation, that's definitely there.
Okay, so now let's turn to the whole idea of stock picking in the first place. I'm a big skeptic when it comes to the thesis that any individual kind of sitting at home at their desk doing research can have a better sense than the market of what's actually happening. And thinking that you can and putting all your money into stocks as opposed to holding a more diversified portfolio ends up being something I think that's very dangerous and more risky than people have a general understanding of, particularly if they have a relatively short time horizon and
haven't
lived through big crises.
Yeah.
And ends up being something dangerous. And on the one hand, you know, I think like the idea of, you know, holding a few hundred dollars of this and a few hundred dollars of that as sort of like a hobby and a way to, you know, keep up on the industry and have a bit of skin in the game to be an interesting one. But having it be a main part of what you're doing with your, you know, retirement funds and your kids' college tuition, I find dangerous and frankly irresponsible. So I'm curious what you guys think about the potential validity of being an independent investor and trying to pick stocks and make money coming in and out of the market.
Okay. Generally, when it comes to this, to like the investing, I tend to be the dumb one, and James tends to be the smart one. I'm dumb and loud. James is smart and quiet.
First of all, I don't know. I would start off with saying, like, investing is very, very, very difficult. It is not something to do and just kind of lightly, you know, sprinkle something here and there and, you know, think everything's going to work out. Diversification is incredibly important. Owning real estate is a good idea. That's usually very different than the market, although can be similar. Owning some bonds and things. Being diversified is definitely worth it. For me, like, I started looking at stocks when I was a kid. And like anytime I made money, I put it in a brokerage account and I've kind of managed it and kind of, you know, I've obviously lost money here and there. I've made some money here and there. But what I found that works for me is you have to kind of lengthen your patience and your time horizon. you can't, like, you know, one of the problems that we have is, like, for psychology for individuals is, you know, we have fear, we have greed, we have cognitive biases, we experience FOMO. You know, you have to fight these urges, and it's really actually very difficult to do. The best thing to do is be extremely patient, do research, have a sort of process or some sort of thesis that you like, and you have to develop that and refine it over time. You know, it's, I mean, another problem that makes it even harder is that there's just so much, especially these days, it was different in the 80s before Reg FD and that, but even now, like, there's just so much more information, and there's so much more information masquerading as fact and opinion masquerading as fact. And so it's hard to actually weed through the signal and the noise. And so, I don't know, I think that's, it's something you have to kind of figure out how to do, and it takes a lot of time, and you have to kind of build the skills to do it, and you have to read a lot of primary source stuff. And it's fun to follow markets. It's fun to follow stocks. You learn about what companies are doing. You learn about interesting business ideas, which can you can apply. You can take an idea from one industry and apply it to your work. You can take, you know, ideas that are going on in China, and you can apply them to what you're doing in the US. So studying companies is fascinating. I mean, there's more interesting stuff there to me. I mean, I'm not a sports guy. I like to play sports. I don't really follow sports, but I really like following companies.
Sure.
Yeah, I would say, like, I mean, I'm very much on the same page as James here. And I don't necessarily disagree with that much about what you said at all, really. But I the joke that I always will say when it comes to, like, stock picking is, like, you know what I also like to do? I also like to bet on NBA games.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, like, I'm probably, when it comes to, like, NBA games, I'm probably, like, 50-50. Like, I'm probably pretty much out even, you know, like, I win as much as I lose, but it makes the games a lot more interesting, and yeah. I understand basketball a lot better. And I make, but I make a lot more money with stocks than I do on NBA games, but I'm half joking here, but, like, I do diversify a lot, right? So my personal account, my play account is, probably, you know, I don't want to go too much into detail, but the account that I have to play with is a single digit percentage of my entire net worth, right? Yeah. So that's just my personal situation. With James, I think it's a good amount more. Yeah. He also spends a lot more time looking into this.
Yeah.
But for me, it's about a reason to learn more about this, right?
Sure.
So one of kind of the inspirations for me to start this podcast was I was always a big fan of The Motley Fool. So they have a podcast network, they have a website, they have advisory services, all looking into, it's all for stock investors, right? And I do think it's very important to have a reason to pay attention to markets and have a reason to pay attention to companies so that you can learn how markets work, right? Learn how companies work. And it gives you an incentive to be educated in this kind of stuff, right? And that's basically, you know, that was a big impetus for me to want to do the podcast. Also, because, like, James does look into this a lot more into detail. So a lot of it was just an excuse for me. Like, I had a beer with James, and I was like, I want to talk to this guy more. This is gonna be an excuse to talk to him once a week.
Yeah.
But I also think with Chinese tech companies, they are so interesting. The characters around them are so fascinating. But they're also it's a different world here in China. They're different companies. And if you're looking at them from the outside and you assume a lot of the assumptions that you might have in the US or in Europe or wherever with a Chinese company, a lot of those things might hurt you. Right. So, you know, you have the common example of, I've mentioned this in an article I wrote a while ago, but, the divergent evolution, right? We use the example of the giraffe and the okapi. So millions of years ago, there was this common ancestor. It was basically like a deer in the jungles of Central Africa, right? And some of those, went out onto the savanna, and they evolved longer legs, longer neck. They become a giraffe. And then in the jungles of Africa now, there's this thing called an okapi, which is basically just a deer, a big deer, right? So you have this one animal that in a different ecosystem becomes this like very majestic, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And this other one that doesn't really change very much. And we do get this with the internet in China, where you have, for example, Google and Baidu, where you had Baidu basically, you know, they start off as a very similar company. They're both search companies, and they both try to go into AI, and Google has succeeded much better than Baidu has, although Baidu has had some success. But Baidu right now is about a $60, $70 billion company, and Google is $400, $500 billion or more. I don't know the market cap right now. But they've become the giraffe in that situation.
Yeah.
Right. And Baidu has struggled. Likewise, Meituan and Groupon. Right. So Meituan basically started as a Groupon clone. Where's Groupon now? They're not doing that well. And Meituan is worth, what, 50 billion?
I forget.
Billion?
Around there. It's big and important.
Yeah.
And that's Hong Kong dollars.
Yeah. No, the USD is some.
Really?
It's like 50 billion. Anyways, but in that case, they've been the giraffe, right? So it's if you aren't actually seeing how these companies work on the ground in China, and also if you're not really looking into their numbers, it can be hard to really get a clear grasp on them. And then also, there has the issue of fraud in the numbers of these companies, but coming out of China is not exactly greater than zero chance, right?
Yeah.
And it's not something that's never happened before. And we do often talk about how when there are certain numbers from certain companies that might look fishy, right? Or that it's really difficult for them to audit that. And that is something that, you know, we want to draw attention to and talk about if it's there as well.
Yeah, if you're going to pick stocks, I mean, you have to pay attention to the details of the companies. Right. I mean, and especially for Chinese tech stocks where you have these business model innovations that create very bizarre new accounting line items and things that have to get defined. And I'm sure their auditors have headaches over trying to figure out what these things are.
Mm-hmm.
You need to try to figure that out. That's sort of a plug for an article coming out on Pinduoduo that I've written. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I just think in general, you know, you look at these studies of professional asset managers and the best of the best of, the hedge funds of the world, and they're basically a coin toss. So the idea that you can sit around and, you know, you don't have a giant research staff and you don't have a professional background and you don't have the type of access that real investors with, billions of dollars to throw around get at these companies. The idea that you can beat them at their game is a fool's errand, in my opinion. So, you know, from your perspective, Elliot, like, yes, as a way to pay attention to this stuff, I think it makes complete sense. And, you know, if you can make $100 here or there, then like, yeah, you're gonna read that extra article you would, as opposed to, you know, watching another episode of a TV show or something that may have less ultimate value to your life or your career. But I would caution everyone to be to be worried and be nervous and be aware of the fact
stocks
that
go down sometimes.
Yeah, be risk averse.
Stocks go down, and there are big macro things that you can't control and have no visibility into and don't really understand that could potentially take a big chunk of your of money that you worked hard to earn away. So yeah, as a hobby, by all means, as a way to inform your what you're doing in your day job, by all means. But as a letting a few early wins get to your head and let you think that you are some sage oracle or the next Warren Buffett, I think is a real fool's errand. And it's something, and it's fascinating watching that having happened to a number of Chinese who've gotten very rich very fast. This is something that you've seen a lot. A lot in the domestic wealth management industry, where people kind of pile into hot things that aren't necessarily all that, not the smartest money, maybe more newer money, and then all of a sudden they just get wiped out.
I mean, I think that's in not just public markets, that's in private markets, private equity, VC as well.
Absolutely.
People chasing the hot thing. That's part of like FOMO that you have to be careful of. The thing is, professional investors that are, you know, some of them use satellites. They're tracking how many cars are parked in, you know, parking lots at Walmart every day, and they're trying to use that to guess what their revenues are on a daily basis and make investments and bets on that next quarter's statements.
Yeah, I saw a great thing about how people are now using Kuaishou, which is this like kind of rural streaming app to understand farming futures. Prices.
Yeah.
You know, who would have known? I mean, there are just so many data sets that you do not have access to and cannot process that
amount of data. That's the problem is it's a processing data problem. But I mean, the problem is those guys are playing a short-term game, and the game that an individual can win at still, it happens to be, I think it's the only one that still exists, the edge that still exists, is to play a longer term game where you're not trying to hit like a quarterly return or monthly return sort of benchmark. You put some of your money in bonds, and when stocks go down, you buy them, and you kind of pick some stocks you like, you follow them a little bit, and you know, when they go down, you add to them. It's kind of it's almost sounds so simple that you'd think, oh, it has to be more complicated than that. In reality, when you try to do it, it is very psychologically difficult.
I think another thing is that I try to do, and you guys can correct, I don't know the data here specifically, is to identify trends, like long-term trends, and invest in them. So like one thing that I think is a pretty reliable trend going forward is the world going cashless, right? So, you know, we've seen it here in China. Nobody really uses cash. I came here with like 2,000 RMB in cash, and I still have not even spent 1,000 of it, you know, after being here for like 3 weeks. And I do think that, you know, we can pretty confident the world's going that direction. So if you look at, okay, well, you got, you know, Visa, MasterCard, Square, PayPal, Alibaba, or Ant Financial, Tencent, you know, you have the key movers in this area. And if you get a basket of them, right, you're betting on that trend, right? And some might do better than others, but I think generally, you know, it'll play out in the right direction.
No.
No.
No. You know, this is not a novel insight that you have.
Okay.
This has been priced in. There are plenty of people who have been thinking about and evaluating this over time. The idea that the world going cashless is going to be the predominant driver of these companies' fortunes, or like the average of these companies' fortunes going forward, I think is not necessarily all that reflective of reality. There are many other things that are happening within the financial services industry, within all these different companies. I mean, Tencent, it's a gaming company. You know, to what extent WeChat Pay plays into that? 40% of their revenues are from, I think even more than 40% of their revenues are dependent on what the Chinese government thinks is a good, has, you know, what the Chinese government thinks
gaming
should be, what role gaming should play in Chinese society. Yeah. So, you know, it's very nice thinking about betting on big trends. And, you know, this may be a more fruitful thing if you're a VC investor and you have a high degree of confidence that this one type of biotechnology is going to be the one that's going to change the world in the next 20 years. And you can bet on the 20 companies that you think have the smartest researchers that are going to be able to make this technology come to pass. But if you're talking about things that are like already like out in the public markets that people have already done a lot of research on, that there's already a lot of understanding of, you know, having that kind of ill-defined a vision, and then making and then like putting you know, some money on 24 on the roulette table, and some money on 26, and kind of hoping it works out. I think there are going to be a lot of other things driving all those stocks and driving that return on that bet that don't necessarily have to do with your insight, which may or may not end up being the case in the first place.
It could be true. I think Tencent may have not been the perfect example along with the rest of them, but. And it could be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but I think,
I mean, a lot of things you'll see, you know, even for professional and managers, they'll have a thesis that is based on some sort of trend that they see, but they'll look at each individual company and analyze it on a much broader level than just that trend. But that's part of the reason why they're looking at that company is it's within that broader. So it's like the biggest one that's been the story in China for like 15 years is consumer. Yeah. Consumer China is created tons and tons of value, lots of valuable companies, and a lot of wealthy investors. You know, I mean, so backing up a little bit, I think what we're getting at here is that there's a fair amount of luck involved in markets, right? Sure. And while you can have some skill and it might help you a little bit, at the end of the day, there's a great quote by Michael Malbison, and I think he got it from Annie Duke, who wrote a book about betting and making bets.
Sure.
She's a poker player. But it's something like trying to decide whether there's skill or luck involved in a game. And if you can fail on purpose, that means there's skill involved.
Yeah.
Now, in stock picking, you can pick a stock and you can think that you're going to fail and you may not. Like, it might actually go up,
yeah.
Right? And it's like on gambling, on the roulette table, you can put money on 27 and you can be like, it's never going to hit 27. And then it hits 27. And you're like, you know, so it's there's definitely luck involved. This is not, that's why you have to diversify. You have to own, you know, safer assets and as well as some slightly risky. You have to create a portfolio that is like, you know, that's, and so there's like so many layers of knowledge that you kind of need to get. You know, you need the basic accounting. You need the basic kind of how to look at a company, how to understand the capital structure. Where are your rights if things turn to shit? As an equity holder, they're at the bottom. But then also like, how do you put a portfolio together of companies? And like, how do you construct that in a way that minimizes the risk and you're not like totally on China consumer risk or totally on China media risk, you know, you or just China risk. Like you want to diversify away from big themes and, and buckets and, you know,
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the that's principle number one, right? Is basically work, save, invest, diversify, hold. Pretty much. But yeah, so.
And do, I mean, you should invest in things that you like that are fun. And that doesn't mean stocks. I mean, like, if you want to, you know, if you like surfing, you should invest in maybe a property near like a beach, you know, like, or invest in, you know, something that's kind of related to surfing, you know, some, like you can do interesting things that are fun and that add value outside of return, you know, to your life. So, you know, you want to like, it's not all about money and like making more money. Like there's some kind of, there should be, what is the point of money? Money is kind of like a vehicle to something. It can be a vehicle to more freedom, to spending time with your family. It could be to giving your kids like a good education. It can be, you know, like, I mean, there's like a lot of giving away and like being philanthropic. There's a lot of things you can do with money that are not just putting a pile of it and locking it in a safe, you know.
May we all be blessed with
luck,
with those sorts of, those sorts of challenges. Elliot and James, thanks so much for coming on China Econ Talk.
Thanks, thank you, Jordan. It is China Econ Tech Investor on this episode.
Right.
It's a crossover episode.
All right. Thanks for coming on China Econ Tech Investor, everybody.
Thanks for doing this podcast, everyone.
China Econ Talk is edited by Jason MacRonald and Kaiser Guo and is a proud member of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For other great shows on China, check out the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, the New Voices Podcast, and of course, the Seneca Podcast, now in its 9th year. Until next week. Shall I take to